Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Thursday the 13th of June, these are our main stories. In Argentina, there have been violent clashes between police and protesters as lawmakers discuss controversial economic reforms. The top US diplomat, Antony Blinken, says a ceasefire deal on Gaza is still possible, but urges the parties to stop haggling. France's main centre-right opposition party votes to remove its leader after he proposed an alliance with the far-right National Rally. Also in this podcast...
It's an intact shipwreck. It hasn't broken. It's lying upright on its keel, slightly tilted over to port.
The ship on which the famous polar explorer Ernest Shackleton made his final voyage has been found. And what's life like on a remote island? We start with Argentina, where protesters have clashed with police in the capital, Buenos Aires. The violence began as lawmakers discussed the controversial economic reforms planned by President Javier Milei, who's promised drastic measures to address the country's dire situation. He wants to introduce a state of emergency for the economy, including cutting pensions. As we're recording this podcast, more than 40 people have been injured in scenes described by local media as a battlefield. Luis Fajardo from BBC Monitoring is following developments from Miami and told me about what's been happening.
There have been very serious disturbances in Buenos Aires around the building of the capital, according to Argentinian media, which of course is giving an extensive coverage of this situation. Apparently, one car belonging to a media outlet, to a major media outlet in Argentina, was burned. And as you mentioned, there have been several injured people. There's a very large presence of security forces around the building. At one point, they were afraid that the situation, they were getting too close to the Congress building, to the Capitol. And the situation continues being very tense, according to Argentina, both in social media and in all kinds of media, which are following this very closely.
And Luis, this comes as lawmakers are discussing the controversial economic reforms planned by the president. Tell us more about that.
Certainly, President Milei, of course, was elected on the promise of carrying out extensive reform in the Argentinian economy, specifically in the state. In the first few months of his administration, he has managed to turn a very large budget deficit into a surplus. Of course, the cost of this has been a very, very drastic cut in government expenditures, including social expenditures that were directed towards the more vulnerable people in society. Now Congress was discussing a measure that would allow him to continue with this, deepening with this process, privatizing companies, reducing the size of the state. As you may recall, during his presidential campaign, one of the strongest image of him in campaign was him wielding a chainsaw and saying he was going to wield a chainsaw to cut through the Argentinian state, which he described as bloated, inefficient, and corrupt. And this, of course, has created a lot of protests, which we are seeing today, of course.
And how widespread is opposition to his reforms within Parliament itself?
President Milei has a very strong opposition by the Peronist Party, the left, the center-left political movement that has dominated Argentinian politics for a long time, since at least World War II, many, many years. And they are very, very strongly against Milei's proposal. So he has faced very strong opposition also in the provincial governments and, of course, a lot of protests by labor unions and these kinds of civil society organizations.
Luis Fajardo. It is time for the haggling to stop and the ceasefire to begin, the words of the US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, as he wrapped up his eighth tour of the Middle East in a bid to finally secure a halt to the fighting in Gaza. But despite all the diplomacy and a UN Security Council resolution, an agreement still seems elusive. Our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman is travelling with Mr. Blinken and sent us this report from the Qatari capital, Doha.
We're in the motorcade, racing through cleared streets of Doha as Antony Blinken in the armoured car ahead of us continues this diplomacy at high speed, trying to keep this ceasefire proposal afloat. There was an embrace and smiles as America's chief diplomat met the Prime Minister of Qatar. The country is a key player in this crisis. For more than a decade, having hosted the political offices of Hamas, Doha has been a conduit in the Gulf for negotiations with Israel. Last night, Hamas gave its response to the Gaza ceasefire for hostage release proposal outlined by President Biden 12 days ago. The Secretary of State, who'd spent much of the night assessing the latest text, seemed exasperated.
Hamas could have answered with a single word, yes. Instead, Hamas waited nearly 2 weeks and then proposed more changes, a number of which go beyond positions that it had previously taken and accepted. As a result, the war that Hamas started will go on. More people will suffer. More Palestinians will suffer. More Israelis will suffer.
Mr. Blinken did not clarify what changes he said Hamas was demanding. It's understood it seeks assurances the ceasefire would be permanent and that Israeli troops would be fully withdrawn from Gaza. These measures are referenced in the existing proposal, but there are caveats around their timing and certainty. Hamas denies it has put forward new ideas, but the reality remains that the proposed deal is stuck between Hamas, accused of trying to change it, and Israel, which is decidedly lukewarm at best about the provisions already on the table. Mr. Blinken said some of Hamas's demands were unworkable, but despite the setbacks, the US, he said, along with Qatari and Egyptian officials, would still try to close a deal.
Tom Bateman. Well, as we just heard, part of that deal involves the release of all hostages. There are still around 120 captives being held in Gaza, 8 months after they were abducted by Hamas. Last weekend, 4 hostages were released in an operation by Israeli forces. Among them was a Russian-Israeli man, Andrei Kozlov. Our Middle East correspondent, Lucy Williamson, has spoken to his parents and has sent us this report.
Hard to tell from inside captivity, the sound of fighting, from the sound of freedom. Israeli hostages, once again the target of a surprise attack, this time by special forces, come to rescue them. Fear, still their first response. Huddled on a bed, they gave their names. Among them, Andrei Kozlov, a 27-year-old man kidnapped from the Nova Music Festival in the 7th of October attacks.
Yes.
Don't be scared, the soldier says. We're here to rescue you. His father, Michael, said 8 months of brainwashing by his captors had left Andrei afraid of his own saviors.
They were told to speak in whispers so that drones overhead couldn't hear them speak in Hebrew and destroy the building to rid Israel of the problem posed by the hostages. When the special forces came for him, he hoped they weren't there to kill him. He wasn't sure if it was a rescue operation or an assassination.
The rescue of Andrei and 3 other hostages was a boost to Israel's prime minister. But the operation caused mass Palestinian casualties and showed the challenge in freeing the other 120 hostages by force. Ending the war is the price for releasing them, Hamas says. If Benjamin Netanyahu wants to save his hard-right government, that might be a price too high.
Lucy Williamson. In France, President Emmanuel Macron is calling on parties and voters to say no to extremes. Speaking at a news conference in Paris, he defended his surprise decision to call a snap election, urging centrist parties to work together after the far-right national rally came out on top in Sunday's votes for the European Parliament.
Since Sunday evening, the masks have come off and the battle of values is out in the open. The Republican right, or at least its leader, has for the first time formed an alliance with the far right. And I do mean the far right when I say the National Rally, because its leaders continue to say that there are real and fake French people and continue to contemplate curtailing the freedom of the press or rejecting the rule of law.
Meanwhile, France's centre-right opposition group, the Republican Party, has moved to replace its leader, Eric Ciotta, after he proposed an alliance with the far right National Rally. Our Paris correspondent, Hugh Schofield, told me more about where this leaves the party.
They've ejected him, but there's going to be a long legal wrangle now over the kind of rules, and it might well go to court, because he's saying that they have got the power to oust him as leader. In effect, he's out because, you know, no one wants to talk to him, and, you know, he's ostracised. But whether technically he remains the Republican's party leader is another matter. And he may, you know, clearly he's been rejected by the important members of the Republican Party and most of the other of their MPs, for example. But his argument is that at the grassroots level, among people who are activists for the party, you know, just ordinary people around the country, there's much more support for what he's doing, which is suggesting this alliance with the RN, the National Rally. So, you know, we're in a slightly odd phase where he's clearly been ejected, but he says he's proceeding with his plan, which is to get candidates which are acceptable to the RN, the National Rally, in a number of constituencies.
But on the left, they're far more unified, aren't they?
Well, they have agreed to, you know, to share out the whole of the country into different constituencies, so that each of the five parties of the left has a certain share out, and that way they'll have a unified front at the elections. And that, I mean, obviously that's a good news for them. That means they won't be fighting against each other. But I think the problem for the left is that, I mean, everyone has seen what, that, you know, that this is a sort of marriage of convenience, and it's, you know, everyone knows that the socialists, for example, and most of them are completely at loggerheads with the LFI, which is the party of Jean-Luc Mélenchon. So, you know, there's a lot of deep division in the middle of that, which, you know, may or may not mean that it all comes unstuck before the elections.
I mean, it is just 3 days. It seems a lot longer than that since President Macron called this snap election. I mean, the picture seems to be confusion in French politics. Is that fair?
Well, absolutely it's fair. It is confusing, though I think a pattern is beginning to emerge. And, you know, and Macron in classic fashion is trying to impose his interpretation of it all on the country. And, you know, it's one which has a certain logic, which is that once again, he finds himself master of ceremonies at the middle, controlling the centre, with on the right, you know, an obviously extremely vibrant, resurgent National Rally, now with some allies in the mainstream Conservative Party. So he's able to say, well, the right's going to the extreme. And on the left, he's got the socialists all the way to the LFI together. And he can say, well, they're all going to the extreme because there's no sort of, you know, there's no normal social democratic party that's not linked to the extremists there. So he says the only way you can vote and that sort of responsibly is for me in the centre.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. He became known internationally under the nickname the Banker to the Poor. Muhammad Yunus was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006 for founding the pioneering microfinance bank Grameen, which is credited with lifting millions of people out of poverty. But now he's been indicted in a corruption case, and earlier this year he was convicted of violating Bangladesh's labour laws in a trial decried by his supporters as politically motivated. The country's Prime Minister, Sheikh Hasina, has accused Mr. Yunus of sucking blood from the poor. Julian Marshall spoke to Muhammad Yunus and began by asking him why there's so much bad feeling between him and Sheikh Hasina.
I would say it's a billion-dollar question. Nobody can figure it out. This is a question that everybody asked. Some explained that it's a jealousy, personal rivalry, or a political threat, or kind of a diversion from politics, move on to the real issues, to something fake.
I mean, she calls you a bloodsucker and says that the rates that you charge on your loans are extortionate.
That's right. That's what she calls me, the bloodsucker. And I try to remind her, or people who are listening, saying that, look, I'm not the owner of the bank. So if somebody is sucking the blood, it's not me. I'm an employee of the bank. And I created this bank, which is owned by the poor people. 97% of the shares of the bank are with the borrowers of the bank. So it's simply give you a bad name. That's all. It doesn't have any justification or anything else.
I mean, as a matter of interest, what are the interest rates?
It's 20%, including all the services that you provide at the village level and so on. You have a huge workforce to serve you, and there's no collateral in the whole system.
If I could turn to the specific charges that have been levelled against you in court today, that you and others embezzled over $2 million from Grameen Telecom that you ran. What's your defence?
The defence is there's nothing called embezzlement or anything. This is a bank account in the name of the workers, the employees. Simply, Telecom came to an understanding, a settlement agreement with the trade union. And under that agreement, they put this money as a payment to all the 5% shares of the profit. That was the issue that was fought over in the court.
You've also got this case against you. Actually, it's resulted in a six-month jail term on labour law violations, which you're appealing against at the moment. Again, your defence against that charge?
This is a case where they were saying that we didn't make the people permanent. The law says if you work for the company for over 6 months, you automatically become permanent.
You say that these charges against you are politically motivated. You've got to fight them in the courts. But, I mean, if, as you suggest, the government, the authorities are out to get you, they're going to get you, aren't they? And you could end up in prison.
Yeah, I'm not the only one saying that this is politically motivated. It's being said by Amnesty International. It's said by United Nations Rapporteur on Human Rights and the Clooney Foundation, who followed this whole case through.
I mean, I've mentioned some of the accusations that Sheikh Hasina has levelled against you, but you equally have accused her of turning Bangladesh into a one-party state. What's your evidence for that?
Well, the evidence is, look at the other parties which exist. I mean, this whole country is run by one party. That's why I was explaining that. It's not me. The whole country believes in that.
I mean, it's quite an accusation to make against the Prime Minister. And you are then surprised that she is so venomous towards you.
Well, it's not venomous against me for one time or other. It's consistently it's going off for the last 20 years.
So what does the future hold for you, do you think, Muhammad Yunus?
Not very bright. It's a very dark future for me. It already is a lot of pressure. This was a time that I thought I could continue to work. We have so many work to be done. And I'm completely paralyzed because of the continuous appearance in the court and new allegations coming in, new statements moving out. So we can hardly work. It's a life where you want to be active. Now you feel like you are dead. You can't do anything. That's the most saddest part of the whole thing, that this is the time the whole team that we have developed over years are so eager to accomplish things and make things happen, but that's not how it looks like.
Nobel Peace Laureate Muhammad Yunus. The ship on which the famous polar explorer Sir Ernest Shackleton made his final voyage and where he died of a heart attack has finally been located. The wreck is lying deep off the coast of Newfoundland in Canada. The Anglo-Irish explorer died on board the Quest in 1922 en route to the Antarctic. Here's an extract from his last diary entry.
4th of January 1922. At last, after 16 days of turmoil and anxiety, on a peaceful, sun-shining day, we came to anchor in Grytviken. How familiar the coast seemed as we passed down. We saw with full interest the places we struggled over after the boat journey. Now we must speed all we can, but the prospect is not too bright, for labour is scarce. The old smell of dead whale permeates everything. It's a strange and curious place.
Well, after that voyage back in the 1920s, the ship had different roles, ending its existence as a Norwegian sailboat before sinking in 1962. David Mearns is part of the team who've been searching for the remains of the vessel. So, how can he be sure they've actually found Shackleton's ship?
All the factors are telling us it's the fact that there are no other ships out here like this one. And this matches exactly the characteristics, the size, all the dimensions, length, breadth, height, the shape of the hull, everything, the fact that we can see a mast. It's very clear that it's Quest. And also, it fits with the navigational position and the analysis that we have about where it was located. So it's undoubtedly Quest. It can't be anything else. Based on the sonar imagery, it's an intact shipwreck. It hasn't broken. It's lying upright on its keel, slightly tilted over to port. It's not covered or anything like that. And so, you know, I expect, to the extent that we'll be able to see the name, I'm sure that will be there, and other numbers or things that are written on it that will absolutely identify it. The whole purpose of this is to bring this story to new generations. Shackleton will live forever as one of the greatest, not just polar explorers, but explorers of all time, because not just of what he achieved in exploration, but the way he did it and the way he looked after his men. And that's a story that will be timeless and be told and told and told again.
David Burns. Still to come on the Global News Podcast.
I always like to show pleasure, life, and some, you know, the futureness, I would say futureness in people.
Ghana celebrates the pioneering photographer James Barner. The shock in India after dozens of the country's nationals were caught up in a fire at a residential building in Kuwait. At least 49 people were killed, most of them foreign workers, and many more were injured. The Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has expressed his condolences and is sending a junior minister to the Gulf state. Our South Asia editor Anbarasan Etharajan is following developments.
This particular incident has triggered lots of concerns in India, particularly in the state of Kerala, from where thousands of people work in the Gulf countries, particularly in Kuwait. Now, the fact that Mr. Modi has tweeted saying, you know, he was worried about those who were injured and offered condolences for those who died shows that a majority of those who died in this unfortunate incident happened to be Indians, Indian nationals. And this particular apartment block, according to Indian media, was full of Indian workers from different parts of the country. And Indian media reports are quoting a very high figure of more than 40 of those who died could be Indians. And the newspapers in the southern state of Kerala, they have been giving the details of those who died in this incident. And that is why Mr. Modi held a high-level meeting, including the foreign minister, Mr. S. Jaishankar. And one of the junior ministers is leaving soon to Kuwait to coordinate work and coordinate help for those who are injured. And the Indian ambassador there also has visited people in hospital. So it is really a testing time for the relatives of those who killed and those who are injured in this incident back in India.
And what do we know about this fire? What do we know about what caused it and what kind of condition this residential building was in?
It's very common for hundreds of expatriate workers, particularly those who come from South and Southeast Asia. They live in one apartment block in clusters. And we still don't know what really triggered the fire. But one worker was quoted as saying that it started in the lower floors and then it spread very quickly, which means basically it trapped those who were living in these higher floors. And many of them died of inhaling smoke, even more than the fire. It was a concrete building. And there was no proper, you know, how to get out of this fire, fire exits or not. And one of these Kuwaiti officials was saying that, you know, he was blaming those property developers and the building owners of not following the rules. And that's leading to such incidents. So the Kuwaiti officials, however, have not come out with the details of the nationalities of those killed. But what we hear is mostly from outside Kuwait, from the media in India.
Anbarasan Etharajan. He's regarded as Ghana's first photojournalist and one of the pioneering photographers in Africa. James Barner has spent more than six decades capturing pivotal moments through his lens. As he turns 95, his remarkable journey is being honoured in Ghana's capital city, Accra, with a series of exhibitions, screenings and concerts showcasing his work. Thomas Nadi reports.
A celebration of life and an extraordinary photojournalism career. It is a journey that started in Jamestown, the historic suburb of Accra, where he established his famous Ever Young studio in the early 1950s.
I photographed all the big politicians right from the beginning, and I photographed in Britain Muhammad Ali, as well as returning to Ghana to introduce color printing. Before then, anybody who took color photographs in Ghana sent it to Europe to be developed. I always like to show pleasure, life, and some, you know, the futureness, I would say futureness in people when I see them. And I like people more than places, because I had that thing in my mind, people are more interesting than places.
Bano was not widely recognized until a 2007 Black Cultural Archives exhibition showcased his work when he turned 80. Many believe he has contributed immensely to photography in this part of the world. But even at 95, James Bano believes there's still more to be done.
When I was 80, I felt then like 21. I just started because there's so much to do. I haven't done all.
James Bano there speaking to Thomas Nadi in Accra. The EU Health Agency has warned that cases of dengue fever and other diseases spread by mosquitoes are rising significantly on the European continent. Scientists say that climate change is one of the reasons why the invasive tiger mosquito has set up home in 13 countries in the European Union. And officials have warned that international travel will further increase the risk of more European outbreaks of disease. More details from our health reporter, Philippa Roxby.
Mosquitoes have been a growing threat in Europe for nearly two decades. One species, called Aedes albopictus, or Asian tiger, is now established in 13 countries, including France, Germany, Spain and Greece. It's also been spotted as far north as Belgium. Disease experts say climate change is creating favourable conditions for the insects. They transmit viral infections like dengue, which causes flu-like symptoms for most, but can be fatal in severe cases. Figures from last year show a steep rise in infections in Europe. Most cases, nearly 5,000, are linked to international travel, but a growing number, around 130, were acquired locally. Mark Allah-Widdowson, lead on high-threat pathogens for the World Health Organization, explains the reasons.
We are seeing a global increase in dengue, a really very marked increase in dengue for a variety of reasons, including urbanization, climate change, and of course people come to Europe, tourists and otherwise, with dengue, and therefore introduce potentially the virus into European populations, and then it can get transmitted.
To date, dengue cases in Europe have been mostly mild, but the worry is that in future, with warming summer temperatures and more infections, that could change. Tiger mosquitoes bite during the daytime and are quite aggressive. Avoiding them can be a challenge. There is concern that the Olympic Games in Paris this summer could raise the risk of more European outbreaks. Advice to the public is to use repellent, wear clothes that cover the skin, and empty stagnant water from gardens where mosquitoes can breed.
Philippa Roxby. If you're feeling overwhelmed by the news or just by modern life in general, perhaps you've dreamt of escaping to a remote island. Well, if you've got around $650,000 to spare, you could buy Mallaghgragh, an island about half an hour by boat off the northwest coast of Scotland. It's said to have stunning views, but not a lot else. There's no running water, no animals, and no trees. Tempted? Well, for an insight into the sort of experience it might offer, we turn to the writer Adam Nicholson, author of Sea Room, An Island Life, about his time on the Shant Islands, three tiny islands also off the coast of Scotland. And we asked him to reflect on their beauty and meaning.
There's nothing quite like the moment when you're left on a remote Scottish island alone or with friends. You suddenly feel that there's something about this place and this geography that is different from the rest of the world. You slow down, you attend to things more closely. You don't care about the news. And every day grows wonderfully long. Since I was a boy in the 1960s, I've been going to the Shant Islands in the Hebrides, just across the Minch from Mullaghach in the Summer Isles that is now for sale. And when my father first took me there, I couldn't quite believe the world was as full of drama as this place of cliffs and surging seas, of hundreds of thousands of visiting summer seabirds hawking and spitting and bellowing around us. All that among all this incredibly dynamic life, I could feel quite so alive. It was pure stimulus for me. And that is a sensation that has never left me. Rekindled every time I go back, knowing that an island mysteriously allows one to be more present in one's own life than anywhere else you could imagine. People always talk about getting away, but island times feel like the opposite of that, getting into something, even getting under something. And so you spend your time exploring every nook and crevice, inspecting every strange nest of shag and cormorant, trying to get close to sleeping seals, very occasionally finding a basking shark or a minke whale easing its way past the beaches, to the point where, however small and uninhabited the island might be, it seems as if you scarcely need anything else.
Adam Nicholson. And finally, the American songwriter Mark James, who wrote two of Elvis Presley's best-known hits, has died. He was 83. Over the course of his career, the composer's work was recorded or covered by artists including Willie Nelson, Jay-Z, the Pet Shop Boys and Michael Bublé. Our music correspondent Mark Savage has more.
We're caught in a trap. Mark James's original recording of Suspicious Minds was a flop. Then Elvis Presley heard it and demanded to make his own version. We can't go on together. It became the star's last number one single in America, and James went on to write several more hits for Elvis, including this. You were always on my mind. Released as a B-side in 1973, it later became a major hit for Willie Nelson, earning James a Grammy Award for Song of the Year. The musician died at his home in Nashville over the weekend.
Mark Savage on Mark James, who's died at the age of 83. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Stephanie Zacherson. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.